What's up, everyone? This is Pastor Sam.
And this is not Danny.
Whoa, we got a white boy with us today.
What's up? I'm Drew. I'm one of the worship leaders here on staff. For those of you that may be listening that you don't know who I am, and I'm happy to just jump in today and talk with Sam about what's going on in John 2. So
yeah, that's right. Danny's on vacation. I just throw him under the bus right there. He's on vacation, which is great. Which is great when we're in ministry, especially Danny's a bivocational. You know, you can get pretty busy lives, and unplugging a little bit and going away, it is important.
Yeah, isn't that taking important time. To rest? Yeah. Taking time, being with family, not having to worry about anything else, and just.
I'll put you on the spot here, Drew. What a one thing you do to relax when you're not in ministry? Because I know we all need to relax, right? I think one of the things that most Christians don't understand is the teaching that Jesus gives us into rest. The Sabbath. The Sabbath is important, right? But the Sabbath is not like as we have thought to be, in a sense that it's like, you know, it's a Sunday, we just worship Jesus and go home. Like, you know, yeah. Sabbath is more about, you know, rejuvenating the soul and resting. I heard a pastor, a friend of mine, say this: divert daily, walk away weekly, and abandon annually when it comes to resting. So he say, divert daily, walk away weekly, and abandon annually. So he's like, this is what I do in order to rest. And he asked me, what do you do, Sam? And I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm still learning when it comes to rest, for sure. I do know I love one thing that refreshes my spirit is just getting out in nature and the beauty of God's creation, whether that's going out and taking, you know, some time and walking a trail or hammocking. Listening to, like, cool. The birds and stuff like that. That's where...
Last time I was in a hammock, I fell, hit my head on the ground, boy. I'm doing that again. That's cool. That's awesome. And around here, there's a lot of places that you can go and walk and enjoy nature. Well, I used to like to go play soccer, but, you know, I'm getting older, so that's not becoming an option anymore. So I'm on a transition thing. I don't know. I think I want to go back to running. Maybe that's be the thing that I do, that I rest, just to unplug and run.
Running. That's not what I think of when I think of rest.
But it has to do with the heart. Yeah. That has to do with the mind. It has to do with the heart and the mind. And I think exercising, that is what it is for me, exercising. Yeah. So I find ways of exercising. But anyways, that's not what the podcast is about.
That's right.
That's right. It's about...
The Gospel of John.
That's right. And this podcast about focusing on some passages that people have some questions about, or it seems a little bit weird. And today we're focusing on chapter 2, verses 14 to 22.
Right. When Jesus comes in, he starts flipping tables and stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Pretty wild right there. So let's read it. Can I read it?
Sure. Let's do it.
And then we'll go on talking. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling ox and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there, and making a whip. That's pretty crazy. Of course, he drove them out of the temple with the sheep and the ox, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. So the Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jews then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple. And will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said these, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. Pretty cool passage.
Yeah.
It's a pretty spicy Jesus.
The spiciest you'll get, maybe.
Maybe. But I think about the roller coaster of the disciples here. Walking with Jesus was a roller coaster, dude. Like, you just come out of a wedding in Cana. partying, not partying as in the world, but having some fun, you know.
Yeah.
He makes a miracle. Things are seem to be like pretty even out. Then his mom and his family goes out with them and things seem to be awesome. And then, boom, Jesus go from...
0 to 60.
Yeah, I know, from chill to like throwing things around. And I'm like, what the heck? What's going on with Jesus here? What are you thinking? What are you thinking?
Well, I just like, I'm thinking how did it get to that point where these people are using the temple for these things? Like, how did that even get to that point? It wasn't always like that, right?
No, it wasn't. You know, on the studies that I did was talking about how this market happened in the Mountain of Olives. And was called Santa Ana. And so people were like, that was a specific place that was called Bazaar of Annas. And so it was normally in Mount Olive. But I think that's what surprises Jesus. It's like, whoa, this market used to happen in the mountain, and now it's happening in the courts, in the Gentile courts. Like,
well, okay, you got to think like this. Think you got these business people, right? And they mm-hmm. know all these people are coming to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wanting to move their business to where the action's at. And that's at the temple during Passover.
Yeah, and so people, the Talmud, T-A-L-M-U-D, the writings of the synagogue teachers. What is a priest? What is a pastor in Jewish? Is a rabbi? Is the writings of the rabbi, sorry.
You're good.
Give me a blank here for a second. It's a writing that rabbis obligated everybody to go to Jerusalem doing Passover. And that's why it started, right? The Passover.
Mm-hmm.
Can I, a side note here, it is important. So, you know, have you ever thought about why it is important that John's always talking about feasts like these? Why he put it there? And back in the day, I was thinking, like, why does he always put it in the time, put it in the frame, in the context of a festival? Actually, what he was trying to do there is tracking time. Is because of the feasts and how many feasts Jesus went in the letters in the Gospels dictates how long was his ministry. So in the book of John, there is 3 Passover mentioned, which means 3 years. That's how we more or less get Jesus' ministry started, and the length of it was 3 years.
That makes a lot more sense, because I was looking at some commentaries getting ready for this, and one of them talked about all the reasons why John would have referred to these feasts. And one of them was like also trying to just educate people,
sure.
Maybe the Gentiles who aren't as familiar with the Jewish traditions and things like, but that, yeah, I didn't think of it as far as like timeline and tracking Jesus's ministry.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that scholars use in order to say, to dictate the timing of Jesus. So 3 Passovers, 3 years. After that, there's no more Passover because Jesus is, we're not wrong, not longer doing that. Jesus is no longer in the context of time, so space and time. But yeah, so going back to the market, all these businessmen for sure knew that these people are coming because these people were told to do that. What is interesting is the fact that what about that specific Passover made the people change the location? I was reading about a little bit about how 250,000 people would go to Jerusalem, that the population of Jerusalem would like go sky high, and the governor would go to the city to make sure that there'll be no riots, to make sure that there is no plotting against the Roman Empire. They gotta keep the Pax Romana. I don't know if you remember what the Pax Romana was the peace with all the gods. The Romans believed that their prosperity came because they had peace with all the other gods. So the governor would be there, and so the Romans were watching this movement from the Jewish people for sure. And so, what are my questions? Like, you know, why made them change from the mountain to the temple? Why would they do that? People needed to do it anyways. It doesn't matter where you're at. They need to go get their stuff.
Sure, yeah. I wonder if it started out as a thing that's like, to do service to people. Like, it's going to be right at the temple. They can just get those animals for their sacrifices, mm-hmm. and the temple's right there. I'm like, what if it started out like that? They wanted to move closer for the sake of the people. And then somebody came along and was like, we can make some extra cash on the side here.
For sure, for sure. But I think you're into something. Most of the evil we see in the world started as something that was good.
That was intended for
good. That was intended for good. Yeah, like, you know... look at love itself, you know, human trafficking started with this idea that we ought to love one another, and now out of a sudden it's all distorted. It became, we're using people,
yeah,
you know, because all you're looking for is love, but that's not how you get that, or even how, you know, many other things that we can talk about that there. That has been manipulated by the enemy in order to deviate us from what God had for us. And that could probably be one of the reasons why Jesus is so mad here, is because he's like, I like the statement that he says, zeal for your house will consume me. That's Psalm 69, verse 9.
Yeah.
And so he's quoting, they're quoting these, they're remembering this about Jesus, and really makes me think about how Jesus, his holiness and righteousness could not bear to see how God's house was desecrated whenever they were supposed to be observing the Passover, the most important feast. Like, so his righteousness and his holiness were like, I could overlook, but I just can't.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the irony of some of that is like, you know, you have the Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, and it was all about this idea of cleansing. And so to me, it's ironic because Jesus is just, he's living up to that. Like, he's like, it's time to cleanse, and this isn't supposed to be happening here, so we got to get that out of here.
Ooh, that's so good. But doesn't that apply to our lives today when it comes to cleanliness and purification and what we call the progression in sanctification journey, where there is some, just got to get rid of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just can be messing with it. It's like, this is not a place for that. And I think there's a lot of things that happens in our heart that are not a place for it to be happening there.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, I don't know, holding grudges, not forgiving, judgmentalism, judging people. Like, there are things that are not to take hold of in our hearts. Needs to be erased, and it should be taken out of it. And for the purpose of purification, of guarding your heart, guarding your mind, so that you not be manipulated by those emotions necessarily, but manipulated by God and God's word, which is what Jesus is saying, what the disciples, John is like, Jesus was like, this is in the other gospels, which we're not bringing a lot, but says, you know, this is supposed to be a house of prayer,
And you turned it into a house of robbers.
Yeah. So Jesus is like, nah, this is a pure time. Let's get this place cleaned up.
Yeah. And there's got to be times when we're comfortable in who we are to say, hey, like, this is unacceptable, you know.
And I think I lack that at times, the self-awareness or self-assessment, where you assessing yourself and saying, you know what, the house is cluttered up enough, you know, it's time to get some stuff up.
Well, it's definitely a lot easier when somebody else comes in. Well, I don't know, maybe not.
Well, when someone else comes and start kicking the tables.
Yeah. Wow. Because you can cheat yourself a little bit. You can always justify things in your mind, but when somebody else comes and calls you out, you got to deal with that.
Yeah, the imposter syndrome is crazy in us, right? Like, we have this idea of just deceiving ourselves, like, to the point that we're like, oh, I'll be fine. And, you know, this reminds me of a conversation I was having with Laura this morning. I have so many t-shirts, not because I buy too many t-shirts, but because I was wearing a t-shirt last night that I had since 2000.
That's crazy.
Was one of the first. Is a Tommy Hilfiger, or whatever you call it, Hilfiger shirt.
Dude, that shirt's almost as old as me.
Oh, dude, that's wild. I'm going to bring it, show you. I'm going to show you that shirt.
That's wild.
It's like, so it's one of the first pieces I bought in the U.S. when I came to the U.S. One of the first. So I still, so that, it is by accumulation. I have so many. So I told her, like, I need to go to this t-shirt place here in my closet. And I have an area for t-shirts. And like, just cleanse this. Take all the t-shirts I'm not going to wear. That is not, it's too big or too small, or I'm not going to wear, and just repurpose for this, you know, mm-hmm. for the sake of the conversation with Laura to repurpose. But, you know, but I had the idea, I had the ability to look from the outside and see there's too many t-shirts. There must be some cleansing happening here. But when it comes to our heart and our mind, our attitudes, our words, I think we lack the ability to do that for ourselves most of the time.
Yeah, I would agree with that, for sure.
But we hate when people point the fingers at it, though.
Especially when they crack down hard. Like, you know, one thing I was wrestling with, and maybe you could speak into this a little bit, I'm like, because Jesus obviously had control over his emotions, right? I think it could be tempting to read into the story and say, wow, it's almost like Jesus lost his cool or didn't have control over his emotions. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't think that's the case. I don't think...
I mean, doesn't Paul say be angry but does not sin?
What does that look like, though?
Well, I think, you know, in Ephesians chapter 5, chapter 4, verses 26, 27, it says, do not let the sun go down your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. So, basically saying, you know, you will be angry. It's okay. That's, you know, it's fine. It's part of human emotions, and I think the church has done a poor job in helping people understand that the emotion of this emotion is not a bad emotion. It's a God-given emotion to us. So I as I have said it before, like, or you know, you can't be manipulated by your emotions.
No, they tell the story.
but you cannot be stoic either. Right, like, so you can't live on both spectrum, or either of those spectrum. One where emotions are just dictating everything about who you are and what you do, and you know, you can't. But you can't be a denier of emotions. And I think in the church we have told people, do not be angry, do not show emotions. Do not cry. Man doesn't cry. You know what? That man doesn't cry comes in. It was a teaching on the church, not a secular teaching. The whole macho idea, you know, came from a biblical perspective. There is a history book about that. I can give it to some people if you want to. But so you go to that point where you're like Saul, not Saul as in Paul, but Saul, the Old Testament, the tough.
Yep.
Guy and just beating everybody at the stake and being tough, and because that's what we're called to do, no crying, you stand firm and all. Then that's a problem there too, because it leads to abuse and leads to all kind of crazy stuff. So I have said this often, and I think it is true about Jesus. I say this because it is true of Jesus. He lived human life with all his emotions, but he controlled the emotions. The emotions didn't control him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, he's saying, like, be angry. He's not saying allow anger
to dictate your life.
Don't allow emotions to dictate your life, to dictate your steps. Be sober-minded. I had a guy tell me this while I was grieving my mom's death, and he was like, be sober-minded. And I was like, I looked at him and I was like, dude, I'm not drinking. He was like, oh, that's not what I'm talking about, Pastor Sam. I'm talking about emotion. Emotion can make you drunk just as much as a beer or wine would. Just as much. And I was like, what? But isn't that the truth?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no psychologist, but I've just heard, you know, I've heard other people say, much more experienced and knowledgeable than I am, that there are different parts of the brain, and you have this emotional side of your brain, and what happens is people get so far into that that they lose like this other kind of cognitive side of their brain that's like the rational side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, and that's when poor decisions are made, is when you're stuck in that emotional mind. It's not that, so what that looks like in a healthy way is like being aware of those things. But again, like you said, not letting those things control you.
Yeah. And we go to emotions like anger, right? So like anger is emotion, and anger can be good, you know, because it can really communicate well boundaries for a specific situation, right?
For me, I kind of see it as passion.
Yeah,
like it means you care.
Sure.
You know, if you're passionate about something, it makes you feel a certain way. Like in this case, like Jesus saw what was going on. He's like, "That's not okay," and I feel that, and I know that in my head, I feel that, and it's like, I've got to respond to this.
Mm-hmm. And he showed his passion there. And but then we talk about anger. But then what about calmness? Calmness. Is that a word?
Calm. Yeah.
Being calm. Calmness as an emotion can be a bad thing. Because it can lead to laziness, complacency.
Sure.
Inaction. Calmness, if it dictates your life, we'll get you sitting on the couch watching a lot of TV. We'll get you doing a lot of things that you're not supposed to be doing at that time. So, I know I use calmness because it's the opposite of anger in my mind.
Yeah, we often don't think of being calm as that can be bad.
It's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it can be just as bad as anger that controls your mind, because it can lead you to a life of ineffectiveness, which means you're not using the talents and the resources that God has given you in order to make the world a better place, because God has intended that you would have a specific role to play and you are not, because you're too calm. So we can talk about that, but can I pick your brain something here? Like,
sure.
Well, it is a comment. What do you do with this? I don't know what, you know, we haven't talked about this, so you're free to share or not share or whatever here. But in all the other Gospels, like the second chapter of them, it is different than this one here, right? Like, we see Jesus being like, you know, in Luke, for example, right? We see Jesus being like tempted, right?
Okay, yeah.
Right? Mark says the same thing, right? Matthew, Jesus in the wilderness. So like, as the story started unfolding, the ministry of Jesus, all the other gospel, the synoptic gospel, takes you to a wilderness. And John doesn't. He takes Jesus to the temple.
It's interesting because there is a temple interaction in all those Gospels, but it happens way later.
Okay, do you know about that? Did you do a little bit of research on that. There's a debate between,
if it's the same interaction or if it's a completely different one.
That's right. Yeah. Where did you land on that?
There are so many.
There's no pressure here.
There are so many similarities to me. It's hard for me to reconcile that it could be two different occasions.
Okay.
But that's just, you know, yeah, from what I've read.
Yeah, I think you can reconcile the timeline and so on and so forth. But I'm not against the two. Just had one earlier and then one later on. Although
you could definitely back it up, because people maybe didn't get the message the first time.
Well, that is true. But I don't. So the reason about that I'm not so big fan of the two happened twice is because I think that if that was happening and Jesus turned the table the first time, the next time Jesus was at the temple, I think the Pharisees and the Sadducees would be like getting the Romans to be stopping Jesus. You know what I'm saying? They seem to be just in as much as surprise as Jesus was when he walks into the temple and he sees these people selling stuff. So they have this like, all the other ones take Jesus to the wilderness and here's Jesus in the temple. What do you do with that?
I think it's maybe just what John may be communicating thematically, like just kind of the journey through like Jesus's ministry. And so you have like the wedding at Cana,
mm-hmm.
and then you come here to this point where, to me, it's like a time of cleansing like we talked about. And so I'm wondering if that had anything to do with it.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're on point. My mind went to, could it be that he's trying to tell us, to teach us that wilderness takes in different forms? Temptations come in different ways. You know, especially if you go to Jesus being tempted, could it be like another test to Jesus in itself? Does that make sense? What I'm trying to say?
You're saying this interaction at the temple is a test in and of itself?
Yeah, why? There's many different wilderness experiences in life. And not all of them happen in the wilderness.
So you're saying maybe his wilderness experience here, I'm just entertaining this for a minute, is like he's all alone in this like desire and passion he has for the temple and what it's supposed to be. It seems like he's all on his own and everybody else has lost that.
While some are in the literal desert, some others are lonely, some others on the loneliness of, you know, the desert of loneliness. You can be in a crowded place and feel alone and be tempted to conform to the crowd and just do what the crowd is doing instead of just doing what the right thing is. You know, I think it's funny that John doesn't take Jesus to the wilderness. He takes Jesus to the temple. But in the temple, Jesus is tempted by the devil just in the same way that he's tempted when he's in the mountain top, or he's in the desert walking there, and he's taking Jesus here, taking Jesus there. And for him to avoid that story altogether, you know, from Luke or even Mark, who briefly mentioned it, for me, it's like, well, yeah, that was one way that Jesus was tempted, but here's a different way that Jesus was tempted, and he overcame it because he applied God's word into his life. Zeal for your house will consume me. And that's what happens. Zeal for God's house consumed Jesus. And he was like, we're not doing this no more.
So I don't want to jump too far forward.
Go ahead.
But what do you think about the people's response to what, you know, Jesus brings out the whip, he cracks down, he's like turning tables. Like, what do you think about these people's response? They say, what sign do you show us for doing these things? And it seems like throughout the Gospels, people are always asking for a sign. How do you deal with that?
Well, I read that verse as into they're asking for validation of his action. So that's what I see that. I think they're like, okay, you want to do all of these? Really? In the temple? You're a brave man. In which authority do you do such a thing? Who do you think you are, bud, to come in here at our house and mess things up?
I think that's what it gets to. Like, sometimes we get in the habit of going to this story and we see it as violence, but really it's just like, it's a question of authority. And that's really what this whole passage is getting at here, especially, you know, when this question comes up. It's like, hey, who are you to be coming in and doing this? So yeah, it's definitely all about authority. I would agree with that for sure.
One thing is that we often are asking Jesus to validate himself in our own lives. What kind of signs are you going to do, Jesus, for me this week so that I can, right?
Yeah.
We are always asking Jesus for validation. And Jesus is like, I'm not doing this. No, destroy the temple and I'll build it up in 3 days. And people goes crazy because you don't understand Jesus saying like, well, I'm just not going to participate on your little game. I'll give you a little riddle for you to figure it out, but I am not playing your game.
You know, even it's interesting when he talks about, you know, destroying this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Mm-hmm. And he's really talking about himself and the people. They don't get it. You know, they respond with, it's taken 46 years to build this temple up. Yeah. It's like just, again, it's like that rational side of the brain, which I'm always there. I'm trying to like rationalize things, which so sometimes it's hard for me even reading scripture and stuff like that when I'm like get to those things, because I always want to rationalize things and be very like logical. And sometimes it can be like metaphoric and I'm like very literal. And these guys just weren't getting the bigger picture of what Jesus was talking about.
And neither did the disciples really, because John, right, John says, verse 22 for me is, I have a really highlighted in my Bible, because, you know, we need to think about this. John was looking back and thinking about the actions, the words, and the things that Jesus did. And he was like, on verse 22, when therefore he was raised from the dead. So after Jesus resurrected, his disciple remembered that he said that destroy his temple. It's like, oh, he was talking about himself back in the day, dude.
I didn't get it.
Remember 3 years ago when he was in the temple and saying, that's what he was talking about. He's talking about himself. Wow, Jesus was clever. You know what I'm saying? So, you're right. They didn't realize.
No, and they, what's interesting is I found, again, just kind of getting ready for this conversation, is like, they brought up that same destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. They bring that back later in the Gospels. I think in Matthew and Mark both, they use that as to convict Jesus of one of the false things he said or whatever. And then it's also like when the people were mocking him, they said, hey, you said you would do this.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm in the process right now. Just <kidding. laughs>
Don't spit up that stuff. I got you. I said it will happen. Yeah, you're right. And that's one of the reasons why we shouldn't believe there is two of those events, just one of the events.
Okay.
Because they are using that same language too close to be two different events for the same, two different, the same wording for two different events. It's too equal. It's almost impossible that something would happen equally at the same time, you know. But that's crazy.
They knew how to use his words, but they didn't know what it meant.
That's right.
Which is interesting. I think that's a whole interesting thought in of itself. They took this thing that Jesus said and just ran with it.
And created this whole narrative and things. And
but didn't take any time to think about what it could actually mean. So
I think that's the problems of the Pharisees, the difference between the Pharisees and Sadducees and the loose disciples. Rather than the 12 and the closer disciples, it was the word intimacy, right? Intimacy calls you to get to know more. Once you ask some questions and dig deeper and explore a few things, where lack of intimacy calls for nothing more, nothing less than just seeing the person and then ignoring them and using whatever they, who they are, what they have said in order to benefit self. And I think that's what the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the scribes, the Romans, and the loose disciples did to Jesus. It was just a means to an end, not the end in itself. And we gotta be very careful not to do the same. Anything else you have it there? Any other topic you wanna bring it up? We covered the whole thing pretty. Well, one thing that we didn't talk about was that I even talked to you earlier was the fact that those sacrifices meant anything, like, you know, the ox and the sheep and the pigeons and all that stuff. I was trying to look for something. Not necessarily when it comes to ox and sheep, but when it comes to the pigeons, where the pigeons were sacrifices that usually people with less privileged people would do it. It was like more poor people would do that kind of sacrifice. It's still costly for them, but it didn't cost an ox because relatively they didn't have money to buy an ox. But, you know, so, and then we see Jesus in Luke, you know, when Jesus is dedicated in the temple, you see his parents offering a dove sacrifice in Luke chapter 2, verse 44. So that's like, I was just thinking about that, like, you know, what was it these people are trying to atone for?
Like, what was the significance between the different animals?
Well,
like, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
I guess
the bigger the animal, the bigger the sin.
Yes.
Or maybe like, the really bigger the bigger time. The pocket, the bigger the animal you gotta buy.
Because it's more of a sacrifice.
If you have $1 million and you buy a $100,000 cow to sacrifice, cool. That hurts. That's what it's supposed to do. But if you are poor and you make $100, well, giving $10 of that is a sacrifice.
Yeah.
But $10 back in the day could only get you a pigeon. So there you go. Now you got it. You got sacrifice too. But it's a pigeon, not an ox. I think it's more about the reality of the the financial situation of the individual than really the sin that they had committed. Everybody had to sacrifice something. Well, Drew, I think we have covered this really good, man. Thanks for jumping in and participating.
Absolutely. It was an honor. Hopefully I made Danny proud.
You did much better than Danny. Much better than Danny.
He's going to have to step up his game next time.
That's right. That's for sure. Well, everybody, as we always say, be blessed.
Be blessed.